You are listening to inspiring stories of ordinary people doing extraordinary stuff. Welcome to the Doolanders.
Hit it!
That's what I'm talking about.
Wait!
Okay, now, from the beginning.
Hit it, boys.
Simon Garlick, welcome to the Doolanders. How are you, mate?
Very good. Thanks for having me on, Blake, Nick. Looking forward to the chat.
Great to have you.
Not as much as us, mate. Hey, we always like to ask our guests on the Doolanders, tell us, who are you and what do you do?
Well, I'm Simon Garlick, as evidenced by your introduction. I am the husband of Lucinda. I'm the father of Bridie, Tom and Sonny, who are teenagers all three. And I'm currently working as the CEO of the Fremantle Football Club. So that's a very high-level synopsis, Blake, of who I am. I don't know if you really wanted to go deep, but maybe that'll happen in the rest of the
podcast. That's all we had time for. So
thanks, Simon. I've got a follow-up question. So if you're the CEO of the Freo Footy Club, but who's the CEO in the household?
I'm going to steal a line from Dennis Thatcher. You guys are similar age to me, I think. And Margaret Thatcher, obviously, was the Iron Lady and was obviously a force to be reckoned with on a global scale. They once asked Dennis Thatcher who wore the pants in the family.
Yeah.
And Dennis said that he definitely wore the pants in the family and he also ironed them.
I like that. I've never heard that before. I like that. So that's going on in your house as well.
Well, yeah. Absolutely.
How is your ironing ability?
Pretty good. It's pretty strong, I've got to say. I am happy to chip in and do what I need to do to contribute. But no, it's a very happy household, Blake. And with that should answer your question in relation to who's in charge.
Stop asking, Blake.
I'm done. That's a really easy to see what the answer is there. Hey mate, we also like to go back to the start of our guests' lives and, you know, just talk a little bit about where you grew up. So you grew up in the southeastern suburbs of Melbourne, not far from what was once known as VFL Park, and what an amazing place that was to view a football game. Shit, it was cold. You played footy for the Glen Waverley Rovers, and I've done my research here, and I used to play footy for the Glen Waverley Hawks.
This is going to get heated now.
This is, because it's similar rivalry to a Freo West Coast type of rivalry. So, mate, as a kid, running around for the Rovers, what was life like, and was playing AFL or VFL back in the day, was that your ambition?
Life was brilliant, mate. I often say I think I had a very stereotypical upbringing in that time. So, yeah, I was born in 75, actually born in Adelaide. We moved to Melbourne when I was 12 months old. So, I'm, you know, a Melbourne boy. We'd go back to Adelaide every Easter and Christmas drive back, which was a lot of fun. But, yeah, I think it was a very much stereotypical upbringing at that stage where, you know, prior to phones or technology or anything like that. And as you say, Blake, we were the end of the train line. And Waverley Station was the end of the train line. And it was nearly, it certainly looked rural. You know, I know now with, you know, obviously population increases, it's not far off being in a city. But at that point in time, particularly I went to a school near the city and you'd have friends who lived around there. And they basically used to talk about how we'd have to go back to the sticks. And there was apple orchards, nothing developed, you know, sort of over our back fence. But it was, as I said, that stereotypical Australian upbringing where you'd get on your bike on a Saturday morning at 8 o'clock and you wouldn't come home until it got dark. And that was just fine. And you'd had a whole heap of adventures. Sport was always a big obsession, I'd say, is the good description for me. And I just fell into that because, you know, my parents weren't particularly sporty. I think it was just friendship groups and, you know, kicking around with guys and girls at school who had similar passions. So it sort of became, and it was every sport you could, you know, much like a lot of kids in that era, it was every sport you could possibly imagine. But footy did start to come to the fore a bit, Blake, to answer your question. So I think I always had that thought that it might be a possibility, but it's sort of not until you get to 14, 15 and, you start to get chosen in some representative sides, and there might be a bit of a pathway appearing before you where it starts to become a bit more than just a bit of a dream. And you might remember those days it was the zone system. So Glen Waverley, as you know, Blake, was the Richmond zone. So you had, you know, real life examples of people who were 4, 5, 6 years older than you going to play at Richmond because they lived in Glen Waverley. So I played in junior development squads with Richmond, and, you know, you'd go to Punt Road and try and make the cut and that sort of thing. So that pathway became clear, and then I actually got chosen to play with Richmond in the under-19s just before they disbanded. I was 15 at the time. It was before it got cut and made way for what's now the TAC Cup. So to get that taste was when, you know, of an AFL or VFL, AFL club at the time, that was when it moved from becoming a pipe dream and something you'd look up at the posters on the wall to something that may be a possibility.
Yeah, well. So take us to that moment when you were drafted. Where were you? How were you feeling?
Yeah, I was at 3 Gels Road, Wheelers Hill. So that was where we lived at that time. It was interesting because I was young for my school year. So I mentioned I'd got played an under-19s in 1991, which was my year 11 schooling year. I was 15, 16. Then finished my year, played year 12, school footy, rep footy, club footy, still playing for the Rovers. And then it was kind of fortuitous because I finished school, so I had no school footy commitments and could just totally focus on playing TAC Cup. Playing under a gentleman by the name of Ray Jordan, whose reputation precedes him as a junior footy coach. Slug was a lunatic, but
what made him a lunatic?
Just his general demeanour and manner, and the way he converted.
Just who he was, right?
He was not dissimilar to a lot of coaches at that time, and you know Ray was renowned as being a developer of young men, but he'd yell and scream, and you know I was coached by Barassi. We'll talk about him in a moment, I'm sure, when I talk about drafting you, but you know that was the way of coaches back then, and I still have I maintain a thought now because it's obviously progressed and it's far more contemporary now. But even though some of those junior coaches who are renowned for developing great young footballers, I think they would have lost as many as they made because you know a good mate of mine at school who was more talented than me. Just didn't like being yelled at, screamed at by a 60-year-old guy and abused on a regular basis. I obviously had that element of determination where I looked at it, I'm going to prove this guy wrong. And so that method of coaching worked for me. But as we know, in coaching, in life and leadership, in business or whatever it might have been, different personality types to respond to different things. So I had that year in 1993 and, you know, the year before Slug had stuck me in a back pocket the whole year and was determined to build some defensive. So it worked in some senses. And then I had a really good year in 93 with the Central Dragons and was picked 49. It was the first televised draft. So this is October or whenever it was in 1993. I said to Mum and Dad, I think Dad might have been at work, Mum, I want to watch it on my own. So I watched downstairs. And I think there was only 60-odd picks, so it was getting towards the end. And, yeah, sure enough, pick 49 by the Sydney Swans. Was pretty excited by that. No mobiles or anything like that at that stage, but the phone started ringing. And then, yeah, the first call I got was from Brass. So he called me 5 minutes later and, you know, was what you'd expect. You know, congratulations, hard work starts now. Get you up here as soon as we can. And it was interesting because it was the first time Sydney for a long time went to the draft. You know, what we talk now, just got kids. Previously, they've been sort of rehashing what in reality were players who had been expendable by other clubs. And it hadn't worked. So, you know, I was one of about 7 or 8 in that draft that came through together. But I had that call from Barass and it was off and running. It was the dream had started. And my first contract, it was the first time that the Players Association had negotiated minimum extensively.
Right.
My first 3-year deal was a base salary of $7,500, second year $10,000, third year $12,500. We got match payments on top of that. So I think from memory it was about $750 a win loss and 1500 a win. So there's high stakes on a win. Mm. And now that might seem like small change at the time, but you know, my mates rang me up, and it was a Thursday, I know, because we went out that night. And apparently it was my shout because I was in the, I had it made.
I love it.
Because I had a big salary of $7,500, which they were all aware of.
Yeah, exactly. Where'd you go? The Wheelers Hill Hotel or?
No, I think we might have pushed it into inner city, the Robber's right. Dog.
Or, I like
or something like that. But. Yeah.
So to give that a bit of context for today's figures, so $7,000, you would have had to get another job, presumably, to fund yourself. And
it was interesting. There was a cost of living sort of. There was a
the cola. Yes,
Sydney. It was, and it was an additional $5,000, which kind of helped a bit. But you're right. It was an interesting time because a lot of my elder teammates were still working full time, so we'd train in the afternoon. I'd come from a background, my family in particular, there was a strong focus on education and the like. So I was banged straight up for uni. It probably segue into another story because Barass was my first call, but the second call was from David Parkin. And the reason that, so I'd done my first year of sports management course here in Melbourne at Deakin University, and Parko was attached to that course. So most people would know David Parkin as a Hall of Fame player and premiership captain and coach, and that's clearly as he's best known for his feats on the field. But his other great passion, and possibly his greatest passion, is education and tertiary education for people. And that's what's driven a lot of his life. So he was heavily involved in the formation of his sports management degree. It was the first of its kind in Australia. Started, I reckon, in 91, and I went through, 93 was my first year. And I loved it. I got enough marks at school to get into law or a couple of other things that were probably things I thought of. But then his sports management degree that was just starting out just had everything that I every subject I looked at thought, that sounds fantastic. And it sort of shaped a bit of how I approached life from him there on in. But Parko rang me, and I'd only had two of his lectures, didn't really know him well. He was this revered figure. Hadn't spent a lot of one-on-one time with him, but so I was surprised to get the call. And he was straight to business. He said, congratulations. They had the next pick or the pick after the next pick, and said, we were going to get you with that, but Sydney looked like they're going down the right path. Great opportunity. Oh, and by the way, I've spoken to a colleague of mine at University of New South Wales, colleague of mine at University of Sydney. We can get you a credit for this subject you did here. You might have to do this one again, but you've got to ring these people on Monday and you can figure it out from there. And it sort of blew me away that he's this legendary figure who was essentially taking such an interest in a, you know, pimply-faced kid that he sort of met a few times at a uni lecture. And it sort of always stuck with me. And I maintained a great relationship with Parko and actually did when I was CEO of the Dogs, we had a great relationship with VU, and I did a commencement speech and told that story, and it went onto YouTube, and I sent it to Parko, and he rang me, and he was really emotional about it, which sort of gives you an indication of how passionate he was about that kind of stuff.
Ahead of his time, like, you know, the clear about what education does and helping build people's capability and rounding them out and all those sorts of things. Hey, when you played for, actually, you mentioned something just before around your approach to life. When you think about your approach to walking into the Sydney Swans, what was your approach and what was your mindset?
Yeah, it was an interesting time because it was a fledgling national competition. You know, West Coast had obviously come in 87. Pros were 90 or 91, something like that. Sydney had obviously moved, South had gone to Sydney all those years before, but were genuinely struggling.
Yeah.
Like, it's a fascinating case study, the Swannies, because they gather as much commercial partnership revenue, so sponsorship revenue, as any sporting club in Australia now. Their research shows they've got over 1 million fans, so they're obviously they've got the paid up members, but you know, they're an incredibly strong organisation. And I look at them a bit now and think about some of the critics around GWS and Gold Coast, and it really is a generational play. It's so that thought of, you know, do we, you know, pull the cord on either of those, I think is sort of misguided, because there were people in the mid-90s saying Sydney's never going to work, it's a rugby town, don't do it, all that sort of stuff. But reason I raised that is because there were still players who were like, I'm not moving interstate. You know, ended up being a great mate of mine. My roommate for a long time was Darren Gasper. So he was the number one pick in that 93 draft.
Yeah.
And he put the princely sum of 70 grand on his head because he wanted to deter other clubs other than West Coast from picking him.
Right.
And he knew Fremantle were coming in a couple of years, so he didn't want to move interstate. Anthony Rocker, you know, the next year or year after was the same. Shannon Gray and all teammates of mine were like, I don't want to go. And so, you know, beggars can't be choosers. I was pick 49. They ran, you know, they read my name out and I was thinking about how quickly can I get up there. And so I had mindset of adventure. How good can this be? Knew, I had an auntie living in Sydney, in Newtown in Sydney. That was my only connection, you know, for the town. But obviously had spoken to the club in the lead up and they were discussing that strategy of we're going to go to the draft. And so you sort of really made footy clubs are brilliant in the sense that if you're moving interstate, you've got an automatic network of your, you know, 40 of your tightest friends and people who are there to look after you. So I certainly had that viewpoint as it being an view of it being an opportunity and an adventure in that sense. And it's certainly something that we now look at things like as a family, and, you know, that's guided a bit of the decision to come over to Perth as well, which I'm sure we'll get to.
Yeah. So you had a long and amazing career. What did you have, 181 games of footy, is that right?
Yep. When I started here, JL introduced me to the playing group and said, you know, Simon played 180, and I interjected and said 181. One game. So I was fortunate. I eked out 11 years and 181 games. There's a little known thing called the 200 Club that the AFL have instituted, and it also counts for life membership. So life membership of the AFL is 300 games. So they include your pre-season games or any representative games.
Right.
So I played 19 pre-season games. So I made the 200 club.
Beautiful.
And sometimes it can't, and you know, you get a tie and they don't even send them anymore, but there's functions and things like that. You actually get two tickets to every AFL game for the rest of your life, which is kind of cool.
That is cool.
And sometimes it comes up, I've had 200 games, but all of my kids, you didn't actually play 200 games.
Yeah, I bet they give it to you.
That's technically true. But come on.
So when you think about, you know, your 11 years in AFL, 181 games, and like, what were the moments that filled you full of joy?
Last 5 minutes of the game when you know you've won. In my world, when, you know, there was an element of survival mode, not survival mode, but, you know, I had patches in my career where I was a lock, but there was a lot of parts of my career where, you know, I'm two or three ordinary games away from being out of the team. Mm. So there is that selfish element where you're hoping that you play well and, you know, maintain your spot. But there was a number of moments in your career, and I can actually remember games, and, you know, particularly at somewhere like the MCG or in my early years at the SCG, which is a magical place to play footy. When you've contributed, you know, you sort of know you've done your job. The game's won with 4 or 5 minutes to go, and you take a little bit of it in. And you hear people talk about that in the grand final, which, you know, I can only imagine would clearly be a pinnacle of a sporting moment. But it was magical too, just in a round 13 game. I remember playing Richmond at one time with the Dogs, and it was a really important game. And all of those things sort of fell into place. And you're there and you're looking at your teammate and you know it's done. So that for me is the magic. And then there's just the, you know, I love the work. I had to be one of the fittest and, you know, have to be at the absolute top of my game because every year, you know, I played at 5'10", so now you'd struggle to get drafted because the mids are 6'2", sort of as a starting position. Yeah. You know, unless you're Caleb Daniel or Little or something like that, you got other attributes. But every year they bring in 10 guys who looked a lot like me and, you know, played a lot like me. So, you know, but I love the preseason. I love the work and the relationship element. And then I just love learning about the code and the work machinations of it and the cultural piece, which is sort of carried through as well.
Yeah, nice. Hey, when you think about that career and the the people that you played with or the coaches that you had, the people that were in, you know, administration, who were the leaders that you reflect on now that had an impact on who you are and how you lead?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think you tend to build the rapport and relationships with people who you're naturally drawn to. And at the time, you might not necessarily think it, but, you know, I had a chairman throughout my something at Swannies for 4 years, but I had a chairman by the name of Richard Collar. So I think Dick ended up being chair at the Swans for something near on 20 years.
Mm.
But Dick's a Perth boy, and I'm fortunate to maintain a brilliant relationship with Dick, as a lot of people who he's been associated with. But Dick, Perth boy, you know, was involved in the formation of the Eagles, I think was their inaugural chair, then moved to Sydney and, you know, has been there now for whatever it is, 40 years, hugely successful from a business commercial sense, you know, his family life and everything else. But he was an all-in sort of guy, which most club presidents, and the good ones in particular, are. And I just remember his passion and his protective nature. Never forget him walking in. So we made the grand final in 96. It was the plugger kicked the point after the siren, yeah, against the Bombers. And Andrew Dunkley, I think, pretty much had belted James Hird. And Hird, he had a cut beneath his eye and stitches and blood and all that sort of stuff. So it wasn't looking good. And Dunks was, you know, he played and done incredibly well on Carey and others, you know, at different stages. So he's a pretty important player. And from memory, I think the club took out an injunction or did something or other and were able to work their magic so that Dunks was eligible to play in the granny. And I'll never forget, I'm getting my ankles taped. This is in the bowels of the SCG and it's training for Tuesday, Wednesday. I don't even know if maybe it was the Thursday. I don't know. And Dick, you know, bowls into the change room, walks in, he looks over and sees Dunks and gives him a massive cuddle and that sort of stuff. And you know, you always got to remember these guys and girls are volunteers. You know, they're not getting paid for these roles and they haven't got an ownership stake and they're not, you know, haven't building equity in a business or anything like that. And I just remember that passion and drive and how committed Dick was. And then really interesting, my first CEO at the Swans was a guy called Ron Joseph.
Yep.
And it's actually Ronnie's funeral today. And Ronnie's a renowned football administrator. He went to South Melbourne, was his team as a kid, obsessed with South, just a footy nut, lied about his age when he tried to get a role as a secretary at North, and they took him on.
Yeah.
And, you know, he and Alan Aylett and a number of others then built North and, you know, we've all heard about the 10-year rule and the way they were able to exploit that and flag in 75, 77 And Ronnie was an old school administrator, but he moved to Sydney, and he was a workaholic, again unbelievably committed to his job, no balance whatsoever in his life. He certainly not the contemporary approach in that sense.
He wasn't ironing his pants, was he? At home.
No, that's right. Yeah. That exact. It's a very good point, Blake. I don't think Ron would have ever picked up an iron.
Yeah.
So therefore, he certainly didn't maintain any, you know, long-standing relationship. Or he wasn't married. So then Ron would just work forever. And when he's trying to build Sydney into a credible club, because the AFL took Ronnie, put him up there to try and run it. Dick was doing his best and doing a fantastic job. You know, Plugger came in, Ruzzi, Barass, all that type of stuff. But Ronnie was doing the work behind the scenes. But he would never have any plans. So there was all these bunch of 18, 19-year-olds who, you know, were always up for free food. So Ronnie would take us out to dinner all the time. Yeah. And it was, you know, it's Mickey O'Loughlin, it's Gas, I talked about before, myself, Shannon Grant, Anthony Rocker, Leo Barry, that whole era of players that came through, and we all became really great mates with Ronnie because he'd take us out from Chinese dinner, you know, feed on a Wednesday night.
Yeah.
Just hanging around. But I also, you know, learnt, and I didn't think I was going to be a CEO of an AFL club, but I think back on the experience I'd have with him and the questions I'd end up asking and all that type of stuff. So he was really interesting. And then I think, you know, I look at players, Scotty Wine, you know, who remains a close friend, who was just a quiet, reserved but really powerful sort of leader. Paul Kelly was a captain of mine at Sydney, who, you know, again, I actually sat next to him at the grand final this year at the AFL function. You get, you know, as a CEO and president, you get invited. So I sat down at the AFL function and Paul Kelly's name's next to me. And he was a bit of a hero. Just as an 18-year-old coming in, as a country boy from Wagga, who just played the game with just such ridiculous intensity. Yeah. And, you know, wasn't an amazing orator or anything like that in terms of when you think of the stereotypical definition of a leader, but God, did you want to play well for him? He was unbelievable. Yeah. So, yeah, there are a couple that probably jump out, Blake.
Yeah, we might. I'll loop back to a bit of that a little later on, because a couple of things that, like, it is interesting that you first went to those administrators, right? All those people that were actually running the organisations, and given where you are today. So, just on that, so you wrap up your 181 game career. You'd been studying sports management. I think you went and got an MBA. Did you finish up in the AFL and go, okay, I'm going to pursue a role in a football club, in an administrative role or a leadership role? Or what was your thought process and on where you went next?
I had a belief that I wanted to work in sport. Yep. But it was by no means was it specific to footy. I'd, as you said, sort of studied the way through. I'd had some work experience at Sydney. So Nick asked the initial phase. I'd studied, but then also I'd finished my undergrad degree. And there was still so much time. And it's sort of the Parco theory, and I still maintain it today, that whilst they're full-time athletes and we pay them, you know, very well in that sense, there's only so many hours a day that it's beneficial to train them. And when I say them, our guys and girls, because it can become counterproductive. So they've got time. So we're really strong here, as are most clubs these days, on, okay, and study's not for everyone. So if it's not study, what is it? Because that element of it's performance enhancing from my perspective, because most of the time in an AFL career, you're getting up from knocks as opposed to getting pats on the back, because it's a hard profession. So if you're dropped or you're injured or you're just not in form and all of your energies are going into your AFL life, you kind of start to equate your self-worth with that. So I think I was driven a couple of things. I think I mentioned before about the study, you know, being something that was really encouraged in our household. But I also, in my mind, I think subconsciously was, okay, I'm probably, whatever contract I sign could well be my last. I always had a bit of that inferiority complex, and I think it served me incredibly well in terms of, I mentioned before, every preseason, the determination and drive, and, you know, that proving people wrong sort of element. But I also was practical about it, saying, okay, so if this is my end contract, I need to get my undergraduate degree. Okay, I want to do a bit of work experience. I did some work experience with a director at the Swans who was an entrepreneur who started a sports management company. It was unreal. That'll help me. Oh, okay, I've got another contract. That's great, but I'll get my MBA. And then I sort of, obviously, you start to think a lot more about it, and sport was the aim, but I had this informal sort of plan in my head that I've got to get some broader experience, because I can't just be the guy not only plays footy and then goes and gets a job in sport, but gets a job at your footy club.
Yeah.
You know, it just didn't make sense to me in that sort of that perspective. So I thought, had this informal rough idea that I need to get 10 years of non-sporting commercial experience, because then that would serve me really well coming back, because I've had the sporting experience. So my last year of playing footy was 2004. The writing was very, very much on the wall. And so we were sponsored, the Dogs were sponsored by an organisation called LeasePlan, which was a corporate fleet management company. Ostensibly, they would finance and manage large fleets for big businesses, whether it's BHP, the federal government, so fleets of 4,000 or 5,000, 6,000. So a bit of an obscure, you know, profession. They're a Dutch company who all process systems. So I got to know the MD there, because whilst you come out of, if you're lucky enough to play to your 30, you you're ostensibly 6-7 years behind your contemporaries. And if you look at it in a brutal way, the people you're competing with for roles and jobs. However, the industry gives you unbelievable experience, an incredible network. And so I always encourage our guys and girls to make sure they utilize that in the right sort of way, because we'll go as a playing group, you go to a function and it'll be a major sponsorship launch or a pre-season season launch or whatever it might be. And most of, in my experience, 70% of their teammates will stick together and stand in the corner and chat and eat the food and get out as soon as I can. And I just had this, and what, like a lot of our guys and girls do now too, is this innate sense, well, I might as well, I'm here, go and have a chat to someone and see what they do. And so Abe Thomas was the MD of Leased Plane Australia at that time, built up a bit of a rapport with him. And I just went to him and said, hey, I've got Thursdays off this week. I don't do any training. That's our mandated day off. Can I just come in and get some experience? You don't have to pay me. Just I've never had any practical work experience. So he said, absolutely, we can do that, no problem at all. They paid me a small amount, which was a bonus, but I got to experience this business that was, as I said before, process systems, run like a well-oiled machine, front of house, so sales, customer relations, but all of their operational capabilities, which was phenomenal. He'd let me sit in board meetings when they took going back to Holland head office and this sort of stuff. So it was, I'd say it was like an executive apprenticeship. It was phenomenal. Yeah. And then on November 1, 2004, I applied for a full-time job at LeasePlan. I remember the date because it was when my now ex-teammates were going back to training. And often as footballers, because you've been living the dream, you have a bit of this mourning period. But we just had Bridie in April of that year, so she's 6 months or so, new job, opportunity to start. I couldn't be more excited. And even though Lucinda used to laugh because, you know, you'd live that dream of literally playing footy with your mates as a living, and I'd come home and she'd say, how was fleet leasing today? And it was funny because it was nearly irrelevant. I was loving it, and I had 6 years there because of this ridiculous learning curve I was going on. And they promoted me a couple of times, I reckon, before I was ready. Got opportunities there I wouldn't have, you know, otherwise, and it was phenomenal. And then, but you know, kept my hand in footy as well, and then led to some other opportunities.
I was going
to
say that other opportunity that it led to was working at the Bulldogs. So you correct me if I'm wrong, you came on as the chief commercial officer and then pretty quickly progressed to chief executive. When you think about what you learnt, so from, you know, those that you'd watched throughout your playing career and what you learned at LeasePlan, so you walked into the Bulldogs and you did a end-to-end strategic review. Is that right? As chief executive, did you do that because you walked in and what you'd learnt previously and from those around you and that at LeasePlan that you thought it was needed, or how did you assess that as you walked in as a, you know, a new chief executive at the Bulldogs?
It was a unique scenario in the sense that I mentioned that I had this rough plan of having 10 years of non-sporting related experience because I thought credibility wise, and you know, you're not just a sporting guy, this guy's had, he's done this, done that, it'll help you just from a pure strategic perspective to get jobs and the like. And so what I had done, I'd been asked by David Smorgan and the board whether I'd sit on the Bulldogs board.
Right.
And that was 2007. So I retired in 2004. That was 2007 because I thought, okay, if I'm going to do this decade, it'll be smart to keep your foot in the door as well and keep connected to the industry so you're not, you know, totally disconnected, even though, you know, I thought about tennis and cricket, golf and all these other opportunities where you could work and wasn't by any means driven solely to work in footy. So the club had been phenomenal for me. You know, as I said a moment ago, I didn't have any ill feeling. Often players can feel like they've been given the boot and they feel a bit of resentment, that sort of stuff. So two things, if they thought I could provide value on the board, great. But secondly, what a great experience as a would have been 32-year-old at that stage to come on board. And clear, I was asked to go on board, I think, under the, you know, the main priority of being the football director. So having input into the footy, you know, being that conduit between the board and the football department, coach and, you know, GM of footy and all that type of stuff, which is great. But what, interestingly enough, and that was stuff I was really interested in and motivated, but I kept getting drawn to the commercialities of the club as well. So as a board member, you, you know, clearly you've got capability to ask any question you like. Most people have a special area of speciality, which of mine was footy, but I was more interested and drawn to the commercial elements of it. So I did that for 3 years. And then, as you say, the CEO at the time, a guy called Campbell Rose, who did a phenomenal job across a whole host of different areas, he was sort of hassling me. These chief commercial officer roles weren't really that, they were kind of new because the industry was growing and a lot of money was starting to come into it from TV rights. So that commercial aspect, you know, was starting to be more prominent. So he created this role and said, we'd love you to do it. And I was still a little bit, oh, you know, not only coming back into sport, I'm doing this great stuff at Leaseplan, getting this great experience and way out of my depth pretty much every day, but amazing learning curve. Do I get back into that now? And I was really torn by it. But seeing the growth of the game and the opportunities and the type of people, you know, Dimitri was obviously running it there. I had relationships with Gil and all these guys, and just seeing where that was all going, it didn't feel like you'd be going to work in footy in the 80s or 90s, where it was, it felt like it was a bigger business and sort of going. Combine that with, hang on, it's a great passion of mine. So, you know, as always, these big decisions, Lou and I sort of talk it through, and I was like, oh, let's, it feels right. So it was a bit of reluctance that I resigned from Leaseplan and took on this role. Did that for 12 months, and then Cam sort of left unexpectedly, had an opportunity. I think there was a thought, it was, certainly wasn't any discussion about it. I think there was a thought of me as a successor,
yep,
but probably 3 or 4 years down the track, Cam left unexpectedly, had an opportunity, you know, unrelated to footy that he just felt like he couldn't turn down. And so David Smorgon was the chair, who ironically was the chairman when I was playing, my through time at the Dogs, so I knew Smorgo really well. And he said, look, we're going to run a process here, external recruitment firm, yeah, clearly at arm lengths, completely professional, but we'd have an interest in you applying if that was something you'd be open for it to. And so, you know, no guarantees and all that sort of stuff, obviously. And so, again, it was a bit of a decision time because knowing the industry and knowing what can happen if things don't work, you know, is a 30, it would have been 35 at that time, if, you know, thinking, geez, that's a big step. If this doesn't work, because of how public these sort of roles are, you know, that sort of stuff can stay with you as well.
Yeah.
Again, working through it with Lou and weighing all things up, a couple of elements. A, what a experience to go through a process like that, even if you don't get it. And B, sort of, I've always erred on the side of having a crack at something as opposed to, you know, playing it safe. So, and I'm going through the process, was fortunate enough to get appointed. So, a long way of answering your question, Blake. But
so, just before you get onto that, like, I'm interested, when you reflect back on the moment that you're sitting at 3 Gels Road and got drafted,
yep,
to the moment that you were said, hey, you got the CEO gig, how different were those feelings? Like, when you think about sense of achievement, was getting appointed the CEO of Western Bulldogs a bigger, in your mind, a bigger achievement or just different to?
Never thought about that.
Ever? Okay.
That's what we do here on the DX, yeah. Simon.
We just ask people that stump our guests. That's right, you know.
I was going to say, in an industry where you get asked the same questions a lot,
yeah.
Kudos to you guys. I don't know. It's a bloody good question. I, as an 18-year-old, you know, getting selected to fulfill a dream is pretty significant. And, you know, I think probably that, but it's probably one I want to reflect upon a bit, Blake, to be frank. I know you're supposed to have all the answers with these sort of podcasts, but...
No, we'll just come back next week. That's fine.
No, you're not. Like, if you've never thought about it, you've never thought about it. Like, just...
What I was going to say was that I think it gets the edge because I didn't grow up as a kid dreaming of being a sporting administrator.
Yeah.
You know, but having said that, I feel like I've got the best job in the world. And that's developed over time in the sense that, and I'm sure we'll get to it, there's so much. I love the industry I work in. I love how dynamic it is, how challenging it is, how how often you get knocked down. But what I love more than anything about it is the cultural element. And you can sort of do that anywhere, but it's particularly heightened in this. So I think I've developed that over time. And then as a 35-year-old getting appointed to be the CEO of the club, it was pretty significant. But I think if I had to pick the two more monumental, I'd probably go with the playing one. You're like, I feel like I found my passion in life in this sort of role.
Yeah.
I was gonna say something just before Blake rudely interrupted with the most seminal question I've ever been asked. So I was gonna mention. So you talked about that strategic approach, and you know, trying to look at a review of the club and where we need to go. So the reason I've raised the board, I had this really strong insight into the club.
Yeah.
And in reality, it was probably an edge over the other contenders for the CEO role. But I'm sure they would have had more experience than me and were older and all that type of thing. But I actually took a bit of a punt in the interview process because this was the end of 2010. So the Dogs had just played in their third consecutive prelim final. So with that in mind, it's like, okay, we're right in the zone here. This is sustained contention, which is the whole idea, certainly what we're aspiring to here at Freo, because there's precedence everywhere of the clubs that can get themselves continually in contention tend to win them, as opposed to, you know, winning one and then falling off the cliff. So if you look at it purely like that, it's like, okay, so what do we need to maintain this? But having that insight that I had, I actually went into the process and, you know, it was the external recruitment firm, two or three board representatives who made up the panel, and they said, what do you think of our on-field prospects? And I took a bit of a punt, but it was what I believed in. It was like, I think we need a complete and utter rebuild from a football list perspective, but a football program perspective. And that's the reason behind saying that was a bit of a risk is because a lot of board members don't want to be, they want to be there when things work, right? You want to be there for the good times. And the dogs historically, you know, the club had been, you know, starved of that sort of thing. So I knew that might count against me a little bit, but I knew I knew as well. So I talked to them about the fact that, you know, there's prelims when you're on the up and there's prelims when you're on the way down. That third prelim, we're an aging team. Barry Hall, Scotty Welsh, Jason Akamanis, a number of others. We just fell over the line in the semi against Brisbane. So it felt to me it was probably a result that was a little bit ahead of where we actually were. And I think there were a whole bunch of signs. And it was 2010, so clubs that were dominant at that time, you know, Hawthorn started coming to their own, Geelong, Collingwood were playing in flags. They were the clubs that were spending, because it was prior to equalisation or competitive balance.
Mm.
And, you know, the numbers showed that there were some clubs spending $2 to $3 million more a year on their football department than the clubs that have not. So Dogs at the time had $12 million worth of debt. Small supporter base, lack of historical success. You know, that we were talking a bit more about demographics and, you know, western suburbs of Melbourne, you know, chronic underinvestment from an infrastructure perspective, health outcomes, a whole bunch of these historical disadvantages. That's no one in particular's fault, but that's what you're dealing with. And then you've got West Coast, who are literally burying money underneath the bowels of their stadium, just being able to invest. So I talked about that, how, you know, whether it be recruiting, our high performance guys, we're one aim behind our back. So I talked about the things that I thought we'd need to do. And I said it was a risk, but it was obviously something that resonated because I got the job. And then, you know, we worked on a whole bunch of things, but the strategy that we undertook was twofold. It was our core business. How do we contend and compete and start again? And it was the community element. So all those things I've spoken about, and the challenges we had as a club. So if we're the club representing that region, how do we, if we're not genuinely involved in the community, and every sporting club talks about it, then we're not being true to ourselves. So we focused on those two things and obviously campaigned when Peter Gordon came in. He and I just campaigned and worked with a number of others about the competitive balance because we were no chance without it. And the beauty of that is I think the Dogs are potentially going to be the first example of a club that used the opportunities that competitive balance provided to build a side that can contend, but also build a sustainable supporter base. Because the Western region of Melbourne is the fastest growth corridor in the country.
Yeah.
And so if they're winning games of footy, And there's a lot of new arrivals there and migrants. So if they're winning games of footy, best way to assimilate into society is following a sporting team, blah, blah, blah. It's been shown along for decades and decades. And the Dogs now have no debt. You know the list they have now should contend, in my opinion, and hopefully do, if it does so for 10 years, then I think they'll move from the perennial battler-type club to one that's quite strong and sustainable, which is the whole idea behind that competitive balance.
Yeah.
Sorry, boys, I went off on a bit of a tangent.
No, that's all right. Hopefully they end up number two for your sake.
Yeah.
So what I wanted to talk about was you brought it up briefly when you're talking about, playing days, and it's also relevant for the business life that you're leading now, and it's about form. So can you talk to us a little bit about what form's like on the playing field? How come some days you're on, how some days you're off? And it's a lot more subtle in the business world, but how do you view it with your eyes?
Yeah, well, I think from a business world perspective, it's very similar on field in the sense it doesn't take much. And, you know, we're at Freo are now encountering a new era for us where there's significant expectation, where over the last 3 years it hasn't really been that. And, you know, we've played two dog-hungry sides in North and the Saints in round one, North in round two, who are on. And it only takes a small amount to be off your game or not at that level. And in this competition, you know, maybe it used to be you have to be 5 or 10% off to really notice the difference. Now it's half or 1%. And I think in the footy world, what the manifestation of it is, it's a lot easier to see in different ways. In the commercial world, it's really difficult to identify because you might come in to your business and, you know, some of your key staff, you have an executive meeting, and it's very difficult to tell straight away if something's off. But it might only be a couple of little things. And it comes to that cultural piece. So we work with, you know, a great external facilitator who, you know, we've engaged on an ongoing basis. And, you know, I were chatting about it yesterday. And sometimes there can be a lag with that. And to your point, Nick, it's a bit of your form. And who knows what that is, if it's, you know, stuff happening on the home front or you're just not feeling quite well, you've got a bit of illness or whatever it might have been. But, again, it only takes two or three little things and you're not making the decisions as well as you might otherwise, or you're putting things off, and that can have a bit of a lag effect. So I think it's a really good, it's not an analogy, but that element of being able to think about yourself in form as a commercial person sounds a bit strange, but it's a really good point.
Yeah. And just on that, like fast forward, we're talking about Freo now, and you think about the volume of time, effort, data, analysis that goes into increasing the capability of on-field performance of players as a leader of the club. When you think about the time that you invest into the capability and performance of the people behind the scenes, you know, be it the assistant coaches, be it the director of football, you know, the psych, whoever it is, how do you think about building their capability?
I think it starts clearly in essentially trying to have the right people in the right spots.
Yep.
Before you're thinking about the development and the building the capability. And that's something that's been a significant focus for us over the last 3 years in particular. You know, our club in a way went through a pretty traumatic experience where the two most senior leadership positions in the coach and the CEO were removed on the same day.
Yeah.
And so that's pretty significant. And then we had a lot of amazing Fremantle people who've done incredible things for this club, who've been here for a long time, and many of them still stay with us today, but there was a lot of change that we enacted as well over some of the past 3 years. And often that can just be the right time, or often it's the right time for the person as well too. The biggest thing that we've looked to do to ensure that we think will help us get us to where we want to get to is have that shared purpose and vision. And it sounds trite and it can sound a bit corny, but, you know, I said before, I'm a sucker for the cultural element of any business, and I read it and consume it as much as I possibly can. But I wanted to do this as soon as I got here. But because of COVID, I was forced we were forced into survival mode. I was appointed November of 19, getting things going. Lou and the kids come over in January 20, and then 2 months later, it all hits. And it's
welcome. Yeah, yeah. Here's a challenge for you.
Correct. And it, interestingly enough, I think it was fantastic in a way, not fantastic, in a way for me personally, because it meant that I had 7, 8, 9 months of getting to know the people, the organisation. I'd done a heap of work in the process, learning about the history and who we are as a club. But then, so towards the end of 2020, as we see a bit of light at the end of the tunnel in terms of, hey, we as a competition and code are going to get through this thing. So we're going to survive. Okay, how do we now start thinking about thriving and building? So we took about a 5 or 6 month process of building the strategic plan that we enacted in 2021. But as a critical part of that was our purpose, vision and value set, or what we call our PVA, our purpose, vision and anchors. And it was interestingly because it was interesting for me because I think what was in place previously was fine. It was okay. But to my mind, a purpose, vision, and value set, if it's okay, it's not okay. It's got to grab you and it's got to be us. And there was a generic element to it. It could have been applicable to a number of other clubs and talked about us being the best AFL club on and off the field. Yet, you know, we're a fascinating organisation in the sense that we're just 28 years of age. We came into the competition at a fascinating stage in the sense that West Coast had come in 87, ostensibly with a state side, had been dominant from day one, and the rest of the competition said, yeah, sure, you guys bring in another team from WA, but they're not going to have a start like that.
Yeah.
And so Wayne Jackson's on the record as saying that they cut too far, you know, the concessions that we weren't given as a club. So that made it difficult, right? However, you know, we're a working-class club. We're a port town, and nothing's been given easy to us. And we kind of take, whilst we haven't potentially achieved the ultimate and what we've absolutely set out for, that breeds this element of drive and determination and resilience. And there's been just a raft of people, of great Fremantle people over nearly 3 decades now who've made unbelievable sacrifices, done amazing things that give us these little pockets of history that are unbelievable. And so we now look at our purpose of being to fight, inspire and win, enrich our community and make the Freo family proud. Our vision talks about holding true to the anchor. So our purpose and vision could only be the purpose and vision of the Fremantle Football Club.
Yep.
You can't apply that to anyone else. Yep. And that came through really strongly, that whole process that obviously I ran, but it couldn't be my purpose, vision, and it couldn't be my strategic plan. It had to be our people. And so it made it take longer, but it's all there. So we've got it all over the place. Yeah. Even the anchor is fascinating because that was a bit of a subject of derision. Our opposition supporters would talk about it weighing you down and keeping you at the bottom. Our playing group actually said, no, we're going to spin this around. That's a symbol of strength. That's a, you know, that keeps you steady in a storm. It's a foundation, something to build upon. So, you know, everything's about our values are called our anchors. You know, we do a whole bunch of things in that sense that sort of lean into our background and history to help us become, you know, what we want to become in the future.
Yeah. I love it. It's a ballsy strategic plan. So you're going to appear in four finals and win a grand final. Ballsy.
Yep.
Yeah, that's a business well-understood business term, I would have thought. 80,000 members you've got. I think
if we don't achieve it, then they will be removed.
Something like that. Yep. So, and it's a big business. I mean, from what I hear or what I've learned is there's 66 million bucks worth of turnover. You know, you're expecting exponential growth on all of that. So, look, we've got about, I don't know, 5 minutes left, but I've got some questions for you on your leadership. So my first question is, actually, who reports directly into you? What are the roles that report directly into you?
Yeah, so you mentioned it before. So our GM of footy, so Peter Bell. So yep. If you think about it, in the footy club, so ostensibly I report into the board of directors.
Yep.
And then our executive team is made up of our GM of footy, our chief operating officer, so Joe Bridie. So Joe looks after all our people and culture, all the operations elements of the business. Our chief commercial officer is Dennis Spicer. So all things consumer and commercial.
Yep.
So when I say that, commercial is a bit more of your partnerships and sponsors, consumers, more your membership, your fan development, merchandise and the like. Casey Passmore. So Casey is a star who looks after our communications, marketing, but also our community division. So Casey has been with the club for 16 years or so and doing a phenomenal job. And then our CFO is Cam Toohey. So they're the roles essentially, and then everything And we've got a phenomenal management team underneath that. So whilst we've got an exec level, we sort of talk about ourselves as a management team. So then underneath that, it's that we've got 12 divisions within the business, essentially, or departments.
Okay.
And so all of those those heads of look after those departments in that sense.
Got it. When you think about you as a leader, what do your direct reports get from you as a leader?
They get my time whenever they need it, which I think is really important. I hope that suggests that they get, you know, unqualified support. But I think it's twofold: it's support and challenge, and the sense that I aim to support 24/7, 365, and that's there ongoing. And the challenge is at the appropriate times. And so I'd like to think my guys feel like I got their back, but it's not, you know, it's not something that goes without being challenged at the right times and with the right mindset. And, you know, probably our most important anchor is club first.
Yeah.
And that's not club first in terms of in front of, you know, put the club in front of your health and your family and the really important stuff. But it's more in the sense of, with every decision you make from a work perspective, with your mindset in relation to how you're treating people, it can't be about a division. It clearly can't be about an individual. So the point of the values or anchors, as we call them, is when you're making a difficult decision and you're making thousands of line ball calls on a daily basis, when those difficult ones pop up, it's, okay, how do our anchors sort of guide us in this sense? So, I'd like to think my exec team feel like they get that sort of support and challenge as appropriate play.
Yeah, love it. You know, you work in an industry that's all driven by, you know, wins and losses and high performance. And so when your feet hit the floor as you come out of the bed in the morning and you're looking at yourself in the mirror and you think about your performance as a high-performing CEO, what does that look like in your mind? Like, what do you think about? I've got to be aspirational, inspirational, consistent. I've got to be highly emotionally intelligent to be able to deal with everything. What's high performance look like for you as a leader and a CEO of an AFL club? Because it's so bloody competitive.
Yeah, mate. Question in the sense that you're not always thinking about this because you can't, because you've got to be in the moment and making decisions and just treating everything objectively as you can. But being in that position too, you also need to be aware of how you carry yourself and what impact that can have, because ostensibly people are looking at you regularly. And so, you know, you come in after a really poor loss, or you might have had a few losses in a row, and if your shoulder's hunched and wearing that, then clearly that's going to make its way and that'll transfer into the organisation. And, you know, when I talked about that change that we made at the Dogs, it was a fully-fledged rebuild, and kudos to the board at the time because they'd committed to it. So you're talking regular losses, 60, 70, 80 points.
Yeah.
And sometimes it was like, wow, this is, you know, a chat to Lou before going and saying, this is tough and, you know, this isn't much fun at the moment. But you'd sit in the car park and before you go in and go, okay, I've got to get in there and get things going. And sometimes it's a front, you know, often you don't have to think that deeply about it if things are going well, clearly. But I think it's also the job of someone in these sort of leadership positions to be really objective about it. And there's a great truism in footy that it's never as good as you think it is, or it's never as bad as it seems. And I think keeping a level of balance and consistency, that you use the word, like, to ensure that, you know, you're not getting ahead of yourself if it's looking really positive. And that's not to be the wet blanket and douse expectation and all that sort of stuff. But by the same token, understanding that when things are feeling really average, but, okay, so what are we doing well? What do we need to work on and that type of thing? So I think, yeah, it's interesting. You always have to be aware that you're having influence in your demeanor, your every conversation, how you're responding, and how you're carrying yourself, which sometimes can get draining as well.
Yeah, I bet. And on that, I've got two super short questions for you. So on that draining bit, how do you look after you on a day-to-day, week-to-week, month-to-month, year-to-year basis to make sure you can perform well?
Yeah, I have and always have had probably a mild obsession with exercise. Sometimes I had to rein that a little. It's certainly not what it was, and I've realised the war's over, so not timing myself on runs or doing anything stupid like that anymore. But I just find I work so much more effectively if I've been active,
yeah,
from a physical sense. So that's usually getting up really early. My knees aren't great anymore, so I reluctantly embraced Lycra about 7 or 8 years ago.
Is it purple?
No, it's not. It's not. But now I'm half obsessed with it and love it. And I find that a great release because there's social element to it, but exercising and, you know, great crew that I catch up with doing that type of thing. So there's elements of exercise and doing that with family as well. We often, we've got a legendary boxing trainer here at the club in Gary Ingraham, or Springer as he's known. Got an unbelievably cool grungy gym in Fremantle, and often there'll be three garlics, whether it's Lou, myself, Bridie, a daughter, my son Tom is boxing, the youngest is just getting into it. And so we often have discussions around who's the pound for pound best fighter in the family at the moment. And so doing that sort of stuff. So that exercise is a cornerstone of it, but then the family element also is key to it. And it's fascinating now watching the dynamic because of, you know, 19-year-old daughter, 18-year-old son, 15-year-old son, as they start to find their ways in life, and I'm hassling them to hang out with them now, and they don't really, you know, it's not as much of a priority for them. So I was thinking, long way of answering, Blake, that balance is pretty critical to it all.
Yeah, love it. Last question. I'm pretty sure you'd have a massive to-do list. If there was one thing you could tick off on your to-do list, what would it be?
Well, yeah, I think the overt answer clearly is, you know, we're here to win premierships. It's in the strategic plan. It's kind of why we exist. So I think that's the one that jumps out. I was just for a moment there, I thought about you're asking about the to-do list today, and it's a bit boring, so I won't go through that with your the Doolanders audience. But I kind of also see that as an outcome.
Yeah.
And again, without sounding trite, I think if in our to-do list, so our purpose is, I mentioned before, to fight, inspire and win, enrich our community and make the Fremantle family proud, the Freo family proud. Kind of idea behind that is if we can sit back at the end of 5 years and think that we've ticked that off on a consistent basis, think the other stuff will look after itself, and you'll get the things that we've said we want to achieve in the strategic plan. So it's a boring one, mate, but the to-do list is to achieve our purpose.
Yeah. That ain't boring.
That's, well, you can tick off being on the Doolanders podcast. That's one big thing. Yes. Next premiership. Yeah.
Well, and that's not boring. It's that's inspiring. And, you know, when you talked about that, there's, you know, no wonder there's a massive purple army with, you know, anchors on their chests running out there to want to win. So, hey, Simon, thank you so much for your time. You have been amazing. Love your story. Super inspiring. And appreciate your time on the Doolanders.
Thanks for having me on, gents. Really enjoyed the chat, and keep asking those questions that no one else has asked.